It's summertime, and the living is far from easy, especially if you're in the legislature. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principle and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Hey, Barry, how are you? I'm glad to be here in the studio with you today. I think we ran a Camp American show last week because you were busy doing your church duties. And we let everybody know you were doing your church duties. You know what? We all have things we got to do, and that means getting 10 pounds of fertilizer in a 5-pound bag is not possible.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that because we might have to do the same thing next week because I have continuing church duties at our denomination's assembly. I've been put on a couple of oversight committees, and so it's going to be I'm going to be spending a lovely amount of time in the warm confines of Chattanooga, Tennessee, in the shadow of Lookout Mountain, working on some church business next week. And then, of course, the week after that, you and I are both going to be pretty busy with a little thing called Camp American.
That's right. So we would like you to find out more about Camp American, www.campamerican.com. Yes, there's room for you. If you're 12 to about 19, you can come as a student. A young student. You can come as an older student. You just don't do some of the cabin games and some of that stuff.
Unless, of course, you really, really feel in your bones like you want to try.
So. And you can also come as a volunteer and still be a student. So that's for adults over the age of 19. Mm-hmm. So again, www.campamerican.com, and we'd love to have you, and we'd love to, if you just want to come up for a visit, call us up, let us know you're coming. You can come up, see what it's all about, see if it's someplace where you want your kids, your grandkids, your nieces and nephews, your neighbor's kids to be involved with, and if so, then we'd love to have them next year. So there you go.
Well, and folks, remember, it's still not too late to sign up for camp. I think there are still some slots available.
Gosh, the early bird discount deadline isn't even till, yesterday.
Oh, okay. So I guess the early bird has found the worm and has flown the coop.
Okay, there's a dirty secret. I don't think we've ever taken full tuition from anybody, including people who got there the day the camp started.
It is a labor of love, but Walmart and the campgrounds won't accept love as payment, so
That's
we have
right.
to charge something for food and room and board. So.
Yeah, we have some very generous donors who make sure that we because it costs far more than we charge per student to run camp, we have people who step in and make sure that we cover expenses. So, that being said, we will gladly accept your tax-deductible donation. Camp American is a 501c3 because we're an educational organization and we don't do political endorsements. And therefore, www.campamerican.com. You can find all the information to make a donation. You can send us a check. You can give me cash. You'll get a receipt.
And trust me, you can give Chuck cash because it goes into the account of Camp American. It doesn't go into the pocket of Chuck Michaels.
No, it does not. I wish it did, but it doesn't.
We are not one of those camps who wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you know, for a little bit more than you can get the deluxe accommodations.
Well, that's what's funny. There are no deluxe accommodations at Camp American.
Shh. You're giving away the secret.
You might get the cabin closest to the path down to the bathhouse.
Okay, well, that may be the most luxurious accommodations we actually have. But yes, folks, there is a bathhouse with the boys' showers and the girls' showers on opposite sides of
concrete walls. Yeah.
And it is enclosed. You still do have to fight mosquitoes and other bugs that fly in there on a regular basis, but otherwise it's pretty nice.
Yeah, and the mosquitoes that you have to fight are occasionally B-17-ish. You hear the flock coming over miles before they get there, and they can be large, but that's part of the price you pay, and it's part of the fun, and it's part of the charm of camp is to deal with those issues and have campfires and be out in the on the lake. I love going to the lake. I'm not a big skier. I'm not a big tuber, but we have skiing and tubing and all that stuff. And I always end up taking a flock of kids down to the go-kart track, which I do like the go-kart track, even though I'm not really, I'm a little large to fit in the in the go-karts. I go anyway. So I don't know. What's your favorite thing to do at camp?
My favorite thing to do at camp is actually to teach. I love having those young people sitting there, even though, you know, depending on when you teach during the week, and Chuck, you know, I'm very flexible, and you've given me, you know, all different aspects and avenues here. I've taught beginning of the week when the students are really just kind of, I'm not sure why I'm sitting in a classroom. I thought we were supposed to have fun.
Yep.
They're really not ready to go yet. To teaching at the end of the week when they're so worn out from all the fun that they've been having and all the classes they've sat through that they're kind of zombies until we get to the Constitution game.
What's funny about that is you've taught on Sunday night.
I've taught on opening night, Sunday night. Yeah.
Which we really try to avoid because, first of all, everybody's kind of still wigged out. They've just gotten their orientation message, which means they don't really know any other cabin mates unless they, you know, they signed up with a friend or a group of friends that they've come with before. They don't know really what's happening, and we throw a class at them. Well, that's happened in years when we've had to get everybody a class. We had to have a 20th class because we only have 19. We had to have a 20th to get it all in, and the only place to put it in is Sunday night. Yeah, and so we don't like doing that. Guess what? We're not doing it this year. So you come, you have orientation, then you do campfire this year once we start. You know, I think we have, we don't feed on the first night. We start feeding you royally on Monday morning, and you eat three meals a day and snacks.
Yeah, it's not bad, folks. I mean, again, they come in, and the cabins are, well, they're getting better as they're slowly but surely taking the old Civilian Conservation Corps campground that this was and turning it into at least mid-20th century camp.
Yeah.
maybe late 19th century, but no.
They do have electricity. There are usually two outlets. One is on and off with the outdoor switch.
Yes.
One is on permanently. Yeah. So we usually make sure that we have a squid so that we, you know, you can plug lots of stuff in. Again, primitive, but workable.
Right.
And it's only for a week.
Right. And they also get, you know, we have cooks on staff there, some of them who are semi-professional at times. I think some of our folks in the kitchen have had real
Charlie Smith
kitchen experience.
Smith has run a restaurant.
Has run restaurants before.
Short order cook.
So they're getting some pretty good stuff. They get three squares a day. There's snack time at night during campfire. They do have all of these, fellowship times with being in class together. We do three classes in the morning, and then they have lunch, and then they go out and do their activities and do the water skiing and the tubing and the miniature golf and all the other little fun things that they do during the day and the things that we set up for them to go to, like go-karts. And my wife is looking forward to that this year, by the way.
Go-karts.
She wants to take every group that wants to go-karting. So,
there's also, we go skating one night every week.
We do roller skating one night of the week. We do bowling one night of the week. We do the go-karts on an afternoon. There's also the beach for swimming. There's paddle boats, the bane of every adult at the camp.
Everybody hates the paddle boats, except the kids.
We also have wildlife because, three years ago, we couldn't even use the camp because there is a nest of bald eagles that's at the top of the hill in one of the tall trees.
Yep.
And last year, we took groups up there to do tours to see the bald eagle nest from a distance, from a slight distance.
And they're very visible.
They're extremely visible. And we've got raccoons who come in and prowl the premises after the light sun goes down, you know. But it's all good, and these are not dangerous to anybody. Nobody's getting hurt, and that we also have we have security on site. The park has folks who come around during the day to check up to make sure everything's good. This is all great. It's a wonderful place to be. It's a wonderful experience for your young people. It's actually a wonderful experience for you as mom and dad too, if you want to come
right
and volunteer to help out the camp. because you can sit in on the classes that we teach.
Right.
And not just that we teach, that people like Dr. Joel McDermott teach, that people like Dr. Michael Kaufman teach, that people like Larry Pratt of Gun Owners of America come in and teach, or, you know, when we have him, Gary DeMar or Tom DeWeese of the American Policy Center, Charlie Smith, who teaches on his...
The growth of government
His voluminous and historic firsthand knowledge of things that have happened in our culture.
That's right. That's right. Charlie's well aware of a number of the things that are going on because he lived it in the 60s.
Yeah. And Dr. Charles Rice from Notre Dame University comes in every once in a while to teach on various topics on pro-life issues and war, just war theory and other things.
And guess what, folks? We have we record those things for your use. That's when we run these Saturday programs where it's a class from Camp American. Those are the audio portions of videos that we've taken at Camp American, and they are available. For instance, Charles Rice's thing on a just war and the way he runs his class, he does what's called Socratic method, which basically he'll lay out a premise, and then he starts asking rapid-fire questions for the students in the audience. And it's a frightening thing when you're in the audience, but what he's doing really is he's training people because he's a law school professor.
Exactly. If you have young people who are possibly interested in becoming part of the legal profession, that's great early experience for them to understand what they're going to deal with for 3 years when they go to a law school.
Yeah.
Because pretty much every law school that's worth their salt uses the Socratic method as their teaching method.
Well, not only that, for the rest of their life in a courtroom setting.
Exactly, exactly.
Or in a discovery session.
Absolutely.
Because you have to think fast. And that's what he does. He trains you how to think fast.
And the big problem, though, happens, Chuck, when these latent law school grads and attorneys transition from lawyers to politicians, they tend to forget that because you can ask them questions and they tend to forget how to answer.
No, the whole problem is they've learned how to answer a question, and sometimes you've asked them a question that there is no way to answer.
Well, that's true.
In a way to put it in a positive light to them, therefore they obfuscate and equivocate.
Right.
So, and by the way, this year I'm teaching a class on tuning up your baloney detector. We explain what a baloney detector is. It's basically, it is a way to tell if you're being told the truth or a lie.
Right.
Because there are two situations. There's a truth or a lie, and we're giving you the tools that you need. And we teach you how, basically, we give you a little lecture up front so you know what you're looking for, and then we do a quick workshop afterwards so that we go through articles here, there, and another place so you can pick them out, and then you're on your own. Then we do a whole hour of you with a newspaper article. Find them.
Find all the fallacies. Now, folks, this used to be called logic, and it used to be taught in the public schools.
Right.
But informal or formal logic, either one, you can honestly, unless you specifically seek a class out in the college level, it's not taught anywhere anymore.
It's informal logic, too. Yeah,
We're not giving it formal if A then B equals C type thing. We're
right.
talking about things like non sequiturs, if then else statements.
That's not what we're doing.
Yeah, we're not doing those type of things. But what we're looking at doing is the what we call the informal fallacies, and those are ad hominem arguments.
Transfer fallacy.
Where
you basically, instead of arguing in favor of your position, you insult your, you essentially insult your opposition and say, you know, they're, you know, alcohol swilling, lying, blah blah blah.
The you're ugly and your mother dresses you funny.
Essentially, yeah. Selective use of evidence, red herrings. Red herring is where you basically bring something else up that has nothing to do with the point in question. The straw man argument, where you essentially take your opponent's argument and make it absurd so it looks ridiculous. Take the worst possible elements of your opponent's argument. There's all kinds of things. Appeal to emotion, appeal to popular appeal. Appeal to individualism, all these appeals that you get bombarded with every day, not even aware of it. And once you have your baloney detector, one of the problems you're going to end up having is finding out a way to shut it off.
And honestly, we don't really think they want to shut it off.
No.
Because the point is that we get fed propaganda, and they call it news.
Right.
And propaganda is the careful and deliberate packaging of fallacies together to sound like actual facts. And the print media, the television media, and pretty much all of your talking heads and pundits out there are well steeped in this way of doing things.
They all do it. Here's the problem. They all do it. We all do it. One of the books I use is actually taught or was written by one of our teachers this year, and he's not teaching this class. It's called Joel McDermott wrote a book called Biblical Logic in Principle and Practice.
Yes.
And one of the things he says is our job as Christians is to get at the truth. That doesn't mean that in our attempt to persuade that we're allowed to use these fallacies. We're learning about them, so we learn to avoid them. Our words should be seen as untainted by these things. So this is one of the ways that we're training you how to do. We're training you how to recognize them, not only in other people's arguments, but in some of your own arguments.
And that's sometimes very valuable to understand, that oftentimes we unconsciously accept those type of premises and then turn around and use them, and we don't think about it because
right.
we've not been trained how to think about it. Now, that's the reason why I love it when Chuck teaches the baloney detector class. I absolutely love it, and I'm looking forward to all my kids who are going to be campers this year. So I'm looking forward to all three of them getting this kind of information and getting an understanding of what it takes to carefully think about what you're doing. Or in other words, the scripture says to take every thought captive to the obedience of Christ.
Exactly.
Because in Christ is truth, and there's no shadow of turning, there's no darkness, there's no falsehood in him. But if we accept the cultural premise of, well, it's okay to bend the truth a little bit if it helps you in a situation or keeps you out of trouble, folks, that's sin. That comes naturally to us from a child up.
Right.
But when we start grasping and understanding the frameworks of this informal logic, what we're really grasping are the rudimentary truths of God's Word and applied in how we interact with one another, how we process how we share information. You know, do we give the gospel by falsifying it or telling people it's something that it's not? Well, some of us do.
Yeah.
Because that's all we were ever taught how to do. But when you start understanding that some of these things are, well, wait a minute, now I can't use that. That's circular argumentation, or that's a transfer fallacy, or that's an ad hominem argument, or an et tu quoque argument.
Et tu quoque. That's a U2. Yeah, U2. And then basically it's like, well, this and that, you did this and this and this and this. Well, U2. That's not a defense. We do see these things, and you see the evangelist who will tell you that if you come over to Jesus, you know, try Jesus because your life will instantly get easier.
Well, not so fast.
Not necessarily. In fact, very, very often your life gets way more complex and difficult. It's not so much in what happens to you in this life. It's what you can expect in the next.
Mm-hmm.
Lay up your treasure in heaven, not on earth, where, you know, thieves break in and steal and moth and rust destroy. What's interesting about that, Barry, is I was just doing my research last night, and I came across, we should all be familiar with this. It's John 18:37-38, when Jesus is in front of Pilate.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, are you a king? And Jesus says, you say so. And he goes into the speech, and what he talks about is the fact that he has come to bear witness to the truth. And Pilate looks at him, and very cynically, you can almost hear the smirk in his voice from the biblical passages, no matter what translation you use, what is truth? And that we live in an era where people are asking, what is truth? Well, the key to that passage is not Pilate's question. It's Jesus' premise. Jesus is making a claim for absolute truth. And the question then is, what is absolute truth? And the answer to what is absolute truth is, it is that which comports with an absolute standard. And that's where the problem is in society these days. That's why we have so many problems. We've been trained that truth is relative.
Right.
There is no such thing as relative truth. It's not true.
That's right, because there's no basis.
There's no basis for it. Now, sure, you can say, well, I like pizza and you like bratwurst. With liking pizza is true for me, but not, you know, necessarily for you.
If you cut the bratwurst up on the pizza, it'd be great.
Yeah. This is a trivial argument.
Right.
It doesn't mean anything because we're not talking about issues of absolute importance. We're talking about whether we like pizza or bratwurst. Well, who cares?
But if you say all roads lead to God and I say Jesus says I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no man comes to the Father but by me, now we're talking about some significant issues.
That is not a true for me and not for you situation. There's one truth.
There's one truth.
There's either many paths to God, which if you think about it is impossible, or there's one path, which is I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father but by me. When Jesus says he's the truth, he is the absolute standard.
That's right.
That's what he meant. And that's what he meant when he told Pilate, I come to bear witness to the truth. What is the truth? It's God, the Spirit, and Christ. Three persons, one being truth.
Absolutely. And folks, that's why we want to have your young people come to camp. We want them to learn how to think. Not necessarily what to think, because that's the beauty of when you engage in biblically grounded logic, is that you will be able to know what is true and what isn't true, what is honest and pure and right. You know, that whole list that we were supposed to, whatever is pure, in Philippians, whatever is pure, what is lovely, what is right, whatever is true, think on these things. That's what we're asking you to do. We're asking you to think on these things and then utilize that thinking to address what's going on around you. Folks, that's the key to changing our culture, is start with Christ and then work your way out to whoever you're voting for president. You know?
Yeah.
Because if you start with president and then you worry about Christ at the very end, honestly, you're not getting anywhere. It's just an exercise in futility.
Well, I'm going to bring up something that wasn't really going to come in today, but it's relevant for the moment, and that is, we all know about Bruce Jenner and what's going on there. Don't worry, we're not going to post any of the pictures on our website, and we're not going to talk about in too many of the terms. But what we're going to say is that I've been asking myself the question, is the fact that he wants to think about himself as a woman the issue? And the answer is no. That merely points out the fact that he is mentally disturbed. Now, you may think that's harsh. Okay, here's why it's not harsh. What did God make him?
Made him male.
It made him a man. God gave him an XY chromosome. How do we know for sure he's not one of these guys who's running around with extra chromosomes and all that stuff? Well, he's fathered children.
Yes.
Now, what was his responsibility? His responsibility, you know, he wants to be this thing. He thinks he wants to be a woman. So he's having surgery and he's taking chemicals in order to make that happen. Does that change your genetic makeup? No.
No.
It not only doesn't, it can't. You cannot change your genetic makeup.
All it does is it messes with the machinery.
That's right. And what it eventually does is leads to major health issues, because God made you to be a certain way with a certain chemical makeup. And when you mess with that chemical makeup, you're going to create trouble for yourself. Well, the guy's 65 years old. How much trouble is he going to have? If he lives 15 more years, he'll be 80. So, you know, that seems like a long time when you're young. When you're old, that's pretty short.
Yeah. Not so much.
Yeah. When you get into your late 50s, early 60s, that's kind of a short period. You start thinking, wow, okay, I've only got that much time to make up, you know, for what I haven't done earlier.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, We're in a fight now about how we refer to Bruce Jenner as, or pardon me, as he likes to say, Caitlyn. Again, that's another thing. Some people say, well, I won't call him Caitlyn, I'll call him Bruce. You know what? I don't care. He can call himself whatever. He can call himself Matilda. He can call himself Snakey. It doesn't matter. It doesn't change what he is. Now, one of the things is you are pilloried in the press and in the on social media, if you insist upon calling him Bruce Jenner, Bruce slash Caitlyn, he, because he has deemed himself to be a woman. Well, what's wrong with that way of thinking, Barry?
Well, let's basically we're making him the ultimate arbiter, and I'm using him.
He is a he.
Making him the ultimate arbiter of what truth is.
Yes. That's part of it.
Okay.
We're another way to put it is that we are making him autonomous.
Exactly.
In the decision over what sex he is. Now, is he really autonomous in that? Well, the answer is no, because he can't change his genetic makeup. He's not autonomous. None of us are autonomous in that. Barry, one of the things that's out there floating around, and you and I talked about it at lunch, is the mm-hmm. next coming thing. We've all seen seen these things coming down the pike. This one is a little less salacious, but it's no less a sign of the mental and moral insanity that we see beginning to course through society as we abandon the idea that God is sovereign. And that is something called trans-enabled.
Yes, and you know, after lunch, before we got in here into the studio, I took a few moments to peruse that article that I said that I glanced at earlier this morning on that. Charles, you and I said this at lunch. We have a culture that is morally insane.
Yeah, morally and mentally insane.
It's insanity. And I mean that in the clinical sense, ladies and gentlemen. Because trans and able are people who want to mutilate their body. Not like Bruce Jenner is trying to mutilate his body to change his gender appearance, but to mutilate their body to remove limbs that are functional so that they can be disabled.
It even goes actually beyond that.
It goes beyond limbs, too, because they're talking about sight, hearing,
yes,
speech. And, folks, there are people who are willfully trying to amputate their own limbs in order so that they can fit into this new subcategory of, well, mental illness.
Not trying, succeeding. Oh, removing arms and legs and that kind of thing, you know, with sawzalls and, you know, trying to convince people it was an accident when it becomes clear you couldn't possibly have done this by accident. You know, we can see a giant gash needing hospitalization and you know, multi stitches and surgery. You removed your leg. That's not possible except on purpose. And we could see this thing kind of boiling up if you paid attention. There was a time when there was a big controversy over, for instance, deaf parents with children or parents who had children who were deaf. And there was a huge argument about parents who were having cochlear implants done so the child could hear. The deaf community was apoplectic because, well, that child is born deaf. He's deaf. You know, we've talked about the autonomy of God. One of the ways God works in his autonomy is giving us the methods to fix mistakes that we have due to the fall. And that's what he did. He made us able to give a deaf child or deaf adults, in some cases, the gift of hearing. So they can hear music, so they can hear kids laughing, so they can hear talking in normal conversation. And that is not an attack on God's autonomy. What is an attack on God's autonomy is saying, no, I want to be something other than what I am. Now, one of the problems with this thing with Jenner is not so much that he himself is insane. When I say that, I mean he's not going to run off with an axe and take out people in a shopping mall. That's not what I mean. What I mean is that society itself, when we sit there and argue, when we have media types who are basically insisting that we use the pronoun she in addressing people like him, he and people like him, and we continue to insist that if they insist that they're a woman, that we have to call them that. Let me ask you a question. We're sitting across from one another.
Yes.
If I suddenly decide that I'm an Eskimo, and I want to be referred to as an Eskimo, and I will have everything, if I go have surgery done to change the appearance of my eyes and possibly the color of my skin a little bit, will that make me an Eskimo?
Let me think. No, it won't.
Now, I might be able to get honorary status by going to an Eskimo tribe and saying, would you guys, mind making me an honorary Eskimo? Yeah, sure, no problem. We'll do that.
Yeah, you could do that. And so in some senses, yes, you could say you're an Eskimo. It's not ontologically true.
Exactly.
But it's true in a sense. Just like Chuck, as we're sitting here at the table and we're looking at each other across the table, I could sit here and say that I'm an NBA basketball star. Now, at less than 6 feet tall and at...
Yeah, you're not less than five. You're less than
I'm
six.
I'm less than six, a few inches less than six, and considerably more pounds than the average under 6 foot tall NBA player, Spud Webb, comes to mind.
I was going to say, remember, he was the dunk champ.
He was the dunk champ, okay? There's no way that I could haul this bulk up 10 feet to put a ball in a basket. But, however, if on the off chance of a plague wipes out all NBA players and all college players, I might get an offer to come and try out.
Possibly. It would have to be a 3-on-3. maybe it's the horse NBA.
Yeah, horse NBA. I think that's right. But the key is, okay, if the right set of circumstances present themselves, I might be able to claim that. But ontologically, it's not who I am.
Well, here's the deal. God creates Eskimos.
Yes, he does.
And he didn't make me one.
Right.
And I can claim to be it all day long. I can claim to be black. It won't make me black. I can claim to be Asian. It won't make me Asian. The fact
or
is...
Or you just claim to be a large enough percentage of either one of those that you can qualify for federal grants.
Well, my family's been in America long enough. We have genes from every possible...
Combination.
Yeah, they're floating around in here. Now, that being said, the insanity of society... is condoning this. The fact is, Bruce Jenner is a he. He can put all the makeup on he wants. He can have all the surgery he wants. He can, do anything he can think of, and he remains a he. And the fact is that society says, well, he says he's a woman, so therefore he's a woman. No, he's not. My wife is a woman. It's an insult to my wife to say that Bruce Jenner, who was not born double X, but XY, is on the same footing as my wife, to be given the same treatment and the same honors as my wife, who was, and I can tell you that she's also not one of these people who's running around, and I'm not one of these people running around with multiple gene, 23rd chromosomes, because we've both parented children. Some of these arguments are so lame, and that's one of the things we're going to teach you how to deal with at Camp American, at least to recognize. Some of these arguments are so lame, and it's just a symbol of the insanity, the current insanity of the culture that we sit by and say, well, okay, whatever, he wants to be a woman, therefore we'll refer to him as a woman. That's why it's offensive, and it should be offensive to women.
Well, yes, it should. And I find it interesting because in the, not that I'm like really going out there and seeking it all that heavily, but I'm not hearing an awful lot of response from most women about this particular revelation, if you want to put it that way, except from Bruce Jenner's wife, Kris Jenner,
who's not real happy,
who's very upset about it, and I certainly can understand her thought is, you know, wait a minute, just like you're saying, you have children, you're a guy. What, you're going to change everything up and then try to have a marriage and a separate and a new family? It doesn't quite work that way.
Yeah, there aren't going to be. Well, first of all, again, he's 65, so he's kind of done with the. Now, how are you going to deal with this? You know, this raises a number of issues with his family because grandchildren are starting to come along. How do you explain grandpa ma?
Grand thing? I have no idea.
Yeah.
Again, we are now, because the depravity of the natural mind of man knows no depths, Chuck. That's as we as good Calvinists, and I know people cringe when we say that.
I know. Yeah.
You know, one of the standards of our framework of approaching the Bible is that TULIP acrostic, which the T stands for total depravity or total inability. In other words, it doesn't mean we're as bad as we can possibly be. It just means there's no good in us without Christ. And sometimes when you're that far away from Christ and you're that far away from truth and light, then you start showing how depraved our natural minds really are, i.e. Bruce Jenner, i.e. the trans-abled movement, i.e. pedophiles, i.e. we can keep going down this road.
Child molestation,
you know,
we just had this
very interesting, and this is going to swing us around to what I was going to talk about here about the legislature.
Good.
Because right now we have got an amendment to the Senate version of the budget that's being offered. I believe Senator Jim Hughes from the Columbus area is planning on offering it to officially ban and increase penalties for bestiality. Because we are starting to see that there's larger, and it's really about animal abuse, but that's what it really gets down to, is human abuse of animals in a sexual manner. Why? Because it's starting to become a recognized problem. As a matter of fact, one of the other senators had sent a copy of a letter that they'd received from the Humane Society and other places, groups all together who are supporting this amendment, but basically showing that in Ohio alone, there are over 80 Craigslist ads for people who are seeking intimate relations with somebody's animals. Folks, I mean, this is the, when Calvinists say total depravity, this is the kind of stuff we're talking about.
Yeah, and we have to be careful because as bad as it gets, we're not at utter depravity.
We're not at utter depravity, although, that's right.
Although that's getting close to the line.
Yeah, utter depravity is basically what hell is going to be like. Okay,
right,
ladies
right.
and gentlemen, that's hell. I mean, that's Satan's condemnation and the pit of hell is utter depravity. That's when you are finally separated from God completely. That's when it's utterly depraved.
Right.
Total depravity means we have no ability in and of ourselves to do anything good outside of Christ because we are born into sin, we are born into darkness, we are born,
right.
as the Scripture says, with hearts that are deceitful and desperately wicked above all things.
Yeah, we're depraved in the totality of our being, but we're not as depraved as we possibly could be.
But this is the point I'm going to make, and I'm going to be talking to some of the senators tomorrow because I'm going back down there, especially Senator Hughes. I want to remind them that in the instance of dealing with this issue, they have to remember this is one of the reasons why they must be extremely, and I can't emphasize that enough, careful, thoughtful, introspective, before in any way, shape, or form inserting the language sexual orientation into any statute in our state.
Exactly.
Because sexual orientation includes that paraphilia, bestiality. It also includes many others. It includes the trans-abled folks. Well, once they become transabled, there is a subcategory of the paraphilias of sexual orientation that actually now finds them attractive.
Right.
And folks, I'm not going to go into any farther because it's too disgusting, but there are hundreds of recognized orientations in the medical literature. And so if we think that we're going to be all these LGBTs and they're just loving everybody, we just got to treat them right and we've got to give them respect and dignity and be tolerant of them. And so we're going to write in the words sexual orientation into any statute dealing with civil rights protections, or preferential treatment. Be careful what you ask for, because you legislators might just get it.
That's right. We are in an era where you have to anticipate how the words will be used in the future. We just went through this discussion. The elders went through this discussion on our church, and we were trying to set some church use policy and marriage policy and that kind of thing. And I said, we have to be very circumspect because we have to anticipate what's coming. It's not just male-male, female-female marriage anymore. Now it's multiple partners. It's animals. There's all kinds of possible. Believe me, you can dream it up and get yourself a couple of PhDs to start writing paper and publishing papers to say it's normal. And before you know it, you got a Supreme Court justice doing the ceremony.
Who will back it up?
Yeah. So that's what we're going to run into. So, yeah, thank you for that, because think about the words where they can go.
And that's part of what I do when I work for various organizations, Chuck, like Citizens for Community Values Action, the Institute for Principled Policy, Ohio Pro-Life Action, you know, the various groups that I work for lobbying down at the state. That's what we try to do, ladies and gentlemen. We try to get them to think logically. We try to get them to see the extended consequences of actions of, we just feel like this needs to be done this way right now. Well, wait a minute. How do you define these things? Who is behind these things? Now, this amendment that Senator Hughes is talking about offering to the budget bill, we would support. Because we think, yeah, you probably need to be pretty strong about this, because that is moral corruption of a nature that is, I don't think we can, you can't morph the whole idea of, alternative lifestyles and just loving each other to fit that. As a matter of fact, I always remember you were there at that one time when I had the debate at Ohio State.
Yes, I was.
During the 2004, the marriage amendment. You were there at that debate when I pressed them on, well, where do you draw your bright line? Which groups who are alternatively attracted sexually do they leave out in the cold when they want to do various
and they didn't want to go there.
They want to change the laws in order to benefit. Is it just for gay males and for lesbians? Is it for gay males, lesbians, and those who are transgendered? Is it gay males, lesbians, those who are transgendered, those who like little children? Is it that, and those who are attracted to animals? Boy, I'll tell you what.
They tap danced real fast to get away from that question.
But that was the point where the entire worm turned in that debate.
You bet
debate.
It did. As soon as
their supporters in the audience realized, hey, they'll cut us out if it keeps them from looking bad.
Well,
the fire was stoked on the other side.
I took a look at it a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the audience members looked at what they looked down into the chasm, and they saw how deep and dark it was, because they're like, oh, this could mean bestiality. This could mean multiple partners. This could any number of things that they wouldn't in a lifetime support.
Or 11 years ago have really gotten comfortable with.
Exactly.
Now, of course, the media has been hugely pushing lately transgenderism and other types of paraphilias as trying to normalize them, just like they have done with homosexuality over the years.
Big Love.
Right. That is
Sister Wives.
Right, exactly. So you're looking at polygamy and multiple. And then you've got these what we call complex marriages, where, okay, maybe we've got three guys and four women, and she's married to him and him, but not to him, and he's married to her and her and her, but is just having intimate relations with the other one without marriage. And she is having sex with her and her, and he's having an intimate affair with him, but they're all in the same house and the same family. And folks, I'm not kidding.
No.
I'm not kidding. I've been reading some research. Matter of fact, if you live here in Columbus, and most people don't do this, but I'm the type of person who is, I believe you have to read what the enemy's putting out there sometimes to figure out what they're doing. There's this little magazine called the 614. It's like a community magazine for Greater Columbus. One of their articles was about
group marriage.
Group marriages.
Yeah.
And how there are some in this community and how they work. And of course, they're not marriages because it can't be. But sure, you do have a couple of people who are actually married to each other, but then he may have her and him that he's involved with, and she may have her and him and him, and,
well,
and
yeah,
the same him between the two. Who knows? It's all mixed.
They have found some guru to give it some kind of a pseudo-official imprimatur. And
if, I remember the article correctly, there was some academic type who was in the middle of all of this, who not only was quote-unquote giving them a scholarly okay on this, but I think was part of the lifestyle.
Well, chances are he's ordained in the Church of What's Happening Now, or the Church of the 11th Commandment, or one of those mail order things. You know, my dad was a bishop in the Church of the 11th Commandment, and that is, thou shalt not get caught. And because he and a friend had talked, they said, you know, you send these guys $5, they'll make you a minister.
Mm-hmm.
My dad said, what happens if you send him 25? He says, I don't know. Why don't you try it? So he sent him $25 and made him a bishop.
And just think, if he'd have given him 50, he could have been
gosh, the Pope. Yeah.
Oh my! But folks, that's part of what our legislature is dealing with right now. They're also dealing with a budget that the House, the Senate, and the governor's office, none of them see the same way on, and that becomes very dicey because, and we're going to talk a little bit about this. You may start hearing the term in the next couple of weeks, continuing resolution. That means we cannot get a budget in place by July 1st, which is our constitutionally mandated deadline to have an imbalanced budget in place for the next 2 years of operation. We may not get there. We may end up having to pass temporary emergency measures to extend the current spending out another week. You know, it may be 3 days, 5 days, a week, 2 weeks, a month. You know, it's hard to tell how they'll do it depending on how the negotiations go. The Senate is going to be putting the final touches on their version of the budget and passing it out probably next week. Then the House will reject it, obviously, and it'll go to what's called a conference committee. Conference committees to iron out the differences between the two sides. Well, the way it's looking, those are going to be two entirely different documents that just say budget and have the same bill number. They're going to have a lot to work out.
Sounds to me,
and they're
like,
going to have 2 weeks to get it done and get it to the governor's desk.
Sounds to me like they're going to have to be locked in a room in the boiler room.
Well,
no, where it's the worst possible conditions.
Well, they won't do it that way. Yeah. They'll be in some comfortable accommodations.
That's too bad.
With staff and researchers and everything else. But the point is, folks, these folks will end up probably going 20 hours a day. I mean, I'm not kidding. They may get 3 or 4 hours of sleep and go right back into it. You may have, and again, things could change between now and next week. From the time we record this to the time it plays, we could have a major change where somebody capitulates and says, well, we're going to go this way with it. And then, you know, and ultimately, really, the governor, Governor Kasich, really wants what he proposed. And usually, historically, governors usually get about 90 to 95% of what they ask for in a budget. you know, because, well, their agencies are the ones doing the work and spending the money, you know. So they usually end up getting quite a bit of it. I mean, even after all the haranguing's done, you just have various little earmarks around the edges that the House and the Senate members get for their districts. But the vast core of it is going to the executive branch agencies, and they're already spending the money before they even approve it. So that's the way it works. But this could be a very significant hang-up for John Kasich's presidential aspirations because, well, first of all, he has to get a budget home and in balance so that he can continue to claim this fiscal champion mantle that he's placed on himself of, you know, hey, he balanced the federal budget. Well, what happens if you can't balance a state budget? What happens if your Republican House and your Republican Senate are so far apart from your Republican governor's wish list that y'all can't agree? What does that do to the potential rising star of John Kasich's presidential ambitions? Well, what it does is it might set them back until they can actually get a budget in place. And that therein lies another problem for our governor. You see, there's this little thing called a presidential debate that Fox News is hosting in Cleveland in August of this year. And in order to be in that debate, Fox has set some guidelines, including you have to be in the top 10 in polling. And you also have to have, like, actually announced that you're running. Word on the street is that Kasich was going to announce the week after the budget was signed by him. So, in other words, after the week after the 4th of July, which gives him plenty of time to go out and build up a momentum to get into the debates. If we push a continuing resolution out 5 days, a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, we're almost the end of July. He probably won't crack the top 10, which means he won't be in the debate in his own state in the first debate of the Republican primary season. That could be very problematic for someone who, as you know, we've got some articles here, and I'm just going to refer to the one of them. And this is coming from the Columbus Dispatch, and this was back a couple of weeks ago, that when he was in Los Angeles, that he said he initially didn't think he would run for president, but realized that there is, quote, no real excitement, unquote, for any of the Republican candidates. And I'm not sure his jumping in changes that parameter at all, but that's okay. But he says, I don't see anybody grabbing and fixing this thing and being the front runner, he told Town Hall Los Angeles. And he quipped that former Governor Jeb Bush is going to have more money than Wells Fargo, but cash won't necessarily translate into grassroots support. But he says, if I have the money, it's most likely I'll move forward. Chuck, if you can't get a budget balanced in a constitutionally mandated time, and you're leaving a lot of folks out there like the healthcare industry, the hospital industry, the insurance industry, the bank, all of the industries that kind of have to rely on the regularity of certain reimbursements and payments from the state government, what does that do to your potential to go and raise money from those folks for a presidential run? It kind of impedes that a little bit. And so it's most likely that if we don't get a budget in place, he's not moving forward. All right. And he might just do so anyway, because he's just going to have to take the risk to try to get into the actual debates.
Yeah. Well, he's not going to get any grassroots support either. I don't know what makes him.
Well, he will only, but in the Ohio primary, he will. Okay, let's just be honest about it. He's the home state favorite. If he jumps in, that's the reason why the legislators are now moving the primary date in order to appease the National Republican the Republican National Committee, the RNC. So that they can create a winner-take-all situation so that if and when Kasich wins the popular vote or wins the primary in Ohio, he gets all the delegates for Ohio.
That really just needs to stop.
Well, and you know what? That's just the games people play, and we're just worried about that. But you know, but he says that somebody asked him at this town hall, and I think this is the key thing, and I think this is where it gets to your point about how's he going to get that grassroots support. He says he was asked how he could survive the gamut of social issues given importance in early Republican context. And by that, they mean life issues. Marriage now is an issue. Gun rights and fiscal responsibility and limiting spending, because those actually are
Obamacare.
Social issues. And Obamacare and health care. Now, his quote was, quote, I'm not going to spend my time dwelling on them. unquote. I'm sorry, it's a Republican primary in a conservative right. state. If you don't spend your time thinking about how you're going to respond to pro-life issues, gun issues. So if you're a governor of a state that says, well, probably as conservative as Ohio is, because Ohio is still a fairly conservative state, and that you're not going to spend any time dwelling on those key base issues for in a Republican presidential primary run, when you have people in the race who are announcing or planning to announce guys like Rick Santorum, guys like Mike Huckabee, guys like potentially Bobby Jindal, Scott Walker, you have got yourself a particular little problem, I think. But he believes that, well, I know he noted that he was a Christian and he's reading a book on prayer. Well, good for him. But he said that Americans have common values regardless of whether they're humanist or people of faith. That personal responsibility, resilience, teamwork, and family. Okay? Those really aren't the things that most people are talking about in a Republican primary season. They're talking about real policy issues like
right.
taxes, jobs, whether or not we're going to honor life, whether or not we're going to stand up for traditional marriage. What are we going to do about the education of our children? Well, you know, he didn't even touch on the whole issue of Common Core, but that's probably because he's kind of tripled down on the issue and is that's going to create some serious problems.
It's radioactive.
It is. I saw you the other day, even Mike Huckabee, who was a big supporter early on, is now trying to backpedal out of the Common Core trap that he let himself get in. But I don't see Governor Kasich taking that route. Again, it's going to be a long, hot summer, Chuck, for policymakers and legislators
yeah.
because, well, the heat is on because of this potential announcement of John Kasich running for president.
And we knew this was coming. We've known this was coming since, what, ran for governor in, 2010?
Yep. Yeah.
We've known that this was supposed to be his stepping stone into the White House. And we warned people of that. I said, this is not a terminal office for him.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the point is, and the other thing, one of the things that he likes to tout is, helping people and pulling people up by going after all this Medicaid expansion money. Well, he was, as he's doing his tour of the country and talking with all of these states. Why did that automatically answer? As he's doing his tour of the country and talking with all the folks in these other states, he went down to Georgia here recently. And this was in the last week and a half. And when he got down to Georgia, the first question he got from the audience was the baseball thrown at 103 miles an hour aimed directly at his head. And that was that whole idea about how is your going after federal money to expand Medicaid radically like you have actually a sustainable long-term model. And Chuck, you and I have talked about this before.
Yeah.
And
it's not.
But his response was, well, I was chairman of the House Budget Committee. We balanced the federal budget, and I took Ohio from an $8 billion hole to $2 billion surplus. If the federal government fools around and changes the former, I've told people in the state we'll get out of it.
Oh, come on.
Okay, but then again, how are you going to replace the, what would be probably $12 billion a year that you're already distributing to people who will then have created a dependency on it because of Medicaid expansion to have their health care coverage and their critical need coverage met? He's like, well, I'm not going to let my budget be put in a hole. And he says, well, my other choice in that decision is to ignore some of the most vulnerable people in our population. And, so he's basically saying, well, we've got to do this to help out the less fortunate. But if the government pulls out the money, which they could, then I'm not going to let my budget be put in a hole, which means
I'll raise taxes.
Of course, on everybody who's not Medicaid eligible. That's the only possible answer you have.
In other words, I am a closet socialist.
I don't think he's actually coming out and saying that, and he probably doesn't believe that himself, but that is the logical results of the path that he's on with his policy.
If A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C.
That's formal logic.
That's formal logic. That's
and,
right.
And even an informal logic, I believe that this is a non sequitur argument on John Kasich's part.
Okay, we're out of time for this week. Please check us out at www.campamerican.com. That's www.campamerican.com. And come out to the Institute for Principal Policy website to see some of these old podcasts and some articles that we've written. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And please join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.